From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, legendary NPR host Diane Rehm talks about the state of journalism and being called the enemy by President Trump. And it was 80 years ago that Texas saw its worst school disaster, the New London School explosion. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. It was near the end of last December that Diane Rehm signed off for the last time on NPR. For nearly 40 years on the air, Rehm brought civil conversation with persistent questions to the power brokers of Washington, D.C. She was in San Antonio for a speaking engagement, and I spoke to Diane Rehm about life after the Diane Rehm Show. Did you miss doing a Diane Rehm Show every day?
Dave, you know, I did it for 37 years. It came to a point where I was turning 80. I knew I was getting close to that real high water mark for me. And it seemed to me that somebody younger, quicker, more open to innovation ought to be at that microphone. Of course, I miss the daily conversations with listeners, but I love what I'm doing in the way of a podcast because it gives me such freedom. It gives me time to play with, to organize that podcast, to make sure we get exactly what we're looking for. And that's different from doing that daily show at 10 o'clock every morning.
While a younger hand is certainly good to have and quicker reflexes, but it's also great to have experience.
Thank you.
Particularly now when so many issues are coming up and we're going, remember that Watergate thing and remember those investigative reporting back then and other issues and how the Saturday Night Massacre and certain things, there's echoes of that in today's news. It's great to have people who remember that originally and who can bring that into focus.
And I do remember all those things so very well. I want you to know, however, the young man who has replaced me, Joshua Johnson, I think is so well-versed in so many issues, not only in the present, but from the past. He is a student of history. He has watched carefully what has happened, and he's bringing that experience to bear.
Well, let's dig into that a little bit. We had a president, Nixon, he had an enemies list. You know, Daniel Shore, one of a former NPR colleague of ours, was on that list, as well as other reporters. We learned that the FBI was tapping the phones of reporters at that time, and we're wondering, we have a president now who calls the American press the enemy of the people. Did you ever think that would happen again?
No, Dave, and that's the part that scares me the most. I believe that the press is our staunch defender of liberty. And it does seem to me that having the President of the United States call all of us the enemy of the American people is frightening. We've seen, indeed, at press conferences that Sean Spicer is calling on only a very few reporters. Nobody from the New York Times, nobody from CNN, nobody from the Washington Post. It's the conservative media he's calling on, and those are the questions he deals with. In addition, the president keeps calling out, he's calling out the former president of the United States and saying that he ordered some kind of surveillance of his telephones without a shred of evidence that any of us has seen so far. So if I had to take my druthers right now, I will, as Thomas Jefferson said, take the press over members of the federal government.
When we have President Trump making this accusation without any evidence that President Obama tapped his phone, and then we're seeing a deafening silence coming from other people of the same party in Washington, D.C., not calling for the proper investigation into what is going on. I mean, what does that mean to the confidence that the American people should have in the President of the United States?
I believe that the Congress would do well, but I doubt it will. It would do well by appointing a special prosecutor totally outside the federal government that indeed the government could not control. Instead, what the Congress is doing is to investigate. They say they are. I presume the investigations have begun on some level. However, thus far, we have seen nothing, we have heard nothing, and now this brand new cache of information dumped by WikiLeaks, embarrassing the CIA, and all along, the president has been praising WikiLeaks. We heard Molly Ball say a little while ago that indeed the president loves WikiLeaks because they dumped all those emails about Hillary Clinton. I wonder when all this is said and done whether he's going to feel the same way.
So here we are, Diane Rehm and myself, talking about these questions about the President of the United States, his relationship with WikiLeaks, his accusations about President Obama tapping his phones, and there's also the specter of his connection with Russia during his campaign. And people think just because we're asking these questions and we're demanding answers, we want to know what's going on, that automatically brands us as
The enemy,
and that and a partisan opponent. We are, and that's another thing that Steve Bannon, the advisor to President Trump, saying that the press is the opposition party. There's a line there where the press is not supposed to cross in the terms of being a partisan participant in these debates. But how do we do these arguments and still stay on the right side of that line, where we can ask the questions, be the eyes and ears and voice of the American people, and still not be dragged across that line?
Dave, I think all of this is going to make every single one of us work harder to do a better job, to make sure we have our facts correct, to not be in a position where somebody can say, well, you said that, and that was a falsehood. They can correct us when we make mistakes, and they should correct us because we do make mistakes. But asking questions that lead to real answers about what's going on in this country is our job. And we must not do what Steve Bannon said. Steve Bannon said, I think you all should shut up. Well, I think we should never shut up. And I, for one, certainly don't intend to.
Well, it's great to know that, Diane Rehm, that you have not lost your fire. Your program that you had on NPR for so many years was known for its civil discourse. I guess this still lives on in the podcast.
Absolutely. And I hope everyone here in San Antonio and everywhere else will listen to it. We've just finished doing a video on how to download a podcast because people where I live, in my building in Washington, keep saying to me, Diane, I hear you have a new podcast. How do I get it? So if you'll forgive me, if you have a smartphone, an iPhone, on there is a little purple icon which says podcast. All you have to do is touch that, and then a page will come up saying search, and all you have to do is type in Diane Rehm. All my podcasts will come up. Just subscribe, and you've got them all.
It just downloads automatically. You can listen at your convenience while you're taking a walk or working around the house or doing anything you want.
Every Friday, we download a brand new one.
It's called Diane Rehm On My Mind.
Right.
And so what does that mean, on my mind?
It means whatever I am thinking about. It means whatever important bill is before Congress. It means whatever the president might have tweeted and following on that. It also means fiction. It also means music. It could mean anything I feel like doing, anything that's on my mind.
On your mind, there are two issues, I guess, that we can talk about that. You're in San Antonio speaking at a Planned Parenthood event, and also Death with Dignity, two issues.
Two important issues, but actually the beginning, the end of life, all about control, one's own control of one's own life. So they are indeed one and the same. And with me will be Jeffrey Rosen, who is the director of the Center for the Constitution in Philadelphia. He'll be talking about how the court is weighing in on issues regarding one's own life. We'll be talking about Neil Gorsuch, the nominee for the court, how he might change the outcome of what's coming before the court. We'll talk about issues that affect every single person in this country.
People probably wonder how you're feeling these days.
Oh, I feel so good. I really do. You know, I'm one of the lucky ones. I come from a Middle Eastern background. And my aunts and uncles all lived into, my aunt certainly lived into their 90s, my uncles into their 80s. I am now 80 years old, and I still wear high heels. I still get around very easily. I do absolutely everything I want. I'm in good shape. Thank you for asking.
I guess people ask you about what can we do about today? How do we join the engagement? Are you still telling people to support public radio and other things?
You bet. Public radio has grown and grown and grown because people like you are broadcasting and people out there are listening. They like the in-depth news they hear on Morning Edition on All Things Considered, coming out of Washington, from Terry Gross, from all of these programs that you here in San Antonio broadcast, that you personally do. That's the kind of information they need, not what they're getting on Twitter every 5 minutes. Not what they're following on Facebook. I think people ought to turn it off for a little while. Give it a rest. Take a breath and listen to in-depth conversation that really does tell you what you need to know. And then helps you begin to ask your own questions. That's what we're here to do. Not provide the answer, but to raise the questions.
Diane Rehm is the former host of The Diane Rehm Show on NPR. She's now producing a weekly podcast called Diane Rehm on My Mind. It was 80 years ago that Texas saw the deadliest school disaster in American history. It was the explosion at the London Junior Senior High School, March 18, 1937. The estimated death toll is about 300, almost all of them children. New London, which is in Rusk County in East Texas, at the time was a boon town because of oil and natural gas. This made New London the richest school district in Texas, and despite that wealth, 3 months earlier, the school board voted to cancel the contract with the United Gas Company to save $300 a month. Instead, the board ordered the plumber to illegally tap into a residue gas line for a local oil company to siphon off free natural gas. That gas line connection was faulty, and it leaked. The school's basement filled with natural gas, and the result was this deadly explosion.
It is with deep regret that we bring you these graphic, appalling scenes of one of the greatest tragedies in American history. Hundreds of school children and their teachers killed and mangled, some of them literally blown to bits, others crushed by falling masonry. When their new consolidated grade and high school in the center of the rich East Texas oil field was shattered by a terrific gas explosion. Had the blast occurred 10 minutes later, school would have been dismissed, and the death toll small, perhaps. But it struck when only the lower grades and a few others had left, catching almost the entire student body in an inferno of flying debris and falling walls. There was no warning. Before the eyes of persons in the vicinity, including scores of parents assembled for a meeting in a nearby building, the schoolhouse, one of the finest rural structures in the country, suddenly burst asunder and collapsed. There's scarcely a home in the entire school district untouched by the disaster. A disaster caused, it is believed, by gas pockets, which had collected in the school's sub-basement.
In the days following that explosion, parents wanted answers. Over 70 lawsuits were filed. They were all dismissed. No school officials were found liable. The story of the New London explosion and its aftermath is told in a book called Gone at 317, The Untold Story of the Worst School Disaster in American History. David M. Brown is the co-author of the book with Michael Wurzchagen.
For many decades after the explosion, the community, New London and much of the community of East Texas, Henderson, Longview, Tyler, they stopped talking about it. It was such a devastating, shocking thing to happen, to have your school children just blown literally to bits. Most of the bodies were not even recovered, just bits and pieces and clothing. They just were so traumatized, they stopped talking about it. And if people came to the community years later wanting to say, to find out what had happened, they would just be met with silence. Just, you know, we don't really like to talk about that. I ran into a little bit of that when I first started researching it 25 years ago, living in East Texas. Some people were reticent. They still didn't want to talk about it. Little by little, I gained some trust. I started doing some interviews. Before it was over, I was able to talk to more than 100 of the survivors and rescue workers and people who had been affected by the disaster. And the story is a narrative history built on their stories and told like a novel of sorts, but it's all scholarly done and documented with endnotes so that all the facts are there. The first definitive book done on this subject.
And they don't have a word, they just don't even talk about it in New London?
The explosion is it. You can say the explosion in Henderson and they know you're talking about the New London explosion.
And this wiped out a generation.
Certainly did. It wiped out a generation of people, and many, it was a setback for the boom. Many of the workers who were there just picked up and left. They didn't want to be close to where this had happened. Took many generations of of soul searching and recovering for some of the children who were involved to ever come to talk about it. And the last few ones who are remaining today are going to meet on Sunday and have a little service and a remembrance of their friends they lost and their teachers they lost. And for anyone in Texas or anywhere who hasn't been, it is a very reverent spiritual event that it's worth going to one of these days.
The explosion happened at 3:17 p.m., and it's interesting that in this early era of mass communication, that it was around half an hour later that it first moved on the AP wire coming out of Dallas. They had gotten word that it had happened.
It took some time to get out. The communications were a little slower then.
That's still pretty good, even for today's day and age, if there's something like that happens.
Yes, it was. They had telephone. They had telegraph. And it was pretty good. Someone picked up the phone and called a wire service, and the communications started getting out. Of course, you didn't have any TV specials going right away on it, but then, as the book talks about, eventually there was a young, energetic radio entrepreneur who on site actually did a nonstop broadcast that was picked up nationally. And I think it's probably the first of its kind. I don't know another example of a national radio broadcast that went live for 36 hours like that one did, the broadcast done by Mr. Ted Hudson.
Does that a recording of that exist now?
No recordings, not even a snippet of it exists.
There was another young, energetic reporter dispatched from Dallas to cover this, Walter Cronkite.
We saw this great pile of debris. That's all it was. You couldn't have identified it as a building. It looked like a pile of debris that might have been bulldozed together into that little area. And hundreds of men looking like ants digging into that rubble, taking stone by stone away, trying to reach, in many cases, their own children. As we got closer, we found that they were tears were smearing their dirty, rough-hewn faces as they were bloodied hands were picking up these pieces piece by piece and eventually finding a body and lifting it out.
Walter Cronkite was in Dallas. He was based full-time in Kansas City Bureau of United Press, and they were sort of switching out some vacation hours, and he had gone over to Dallas to fill in for a reporter and was on the desk in the afternoon when the call came in to United Press where he was working. He and the United Press bureau chief left in a car and went immediately to New London. Now, Cronkite was 22. He was a pretty rookie reporter. This would be the first huge story he ever worked on, and a story that even late in life he would call the most tragic story involving mostly children outside of anything that he covered in war, which is incomparable to other disasters.
And there were newsreels that showed up. We have a record of that.
There are newsreels. There were several newsreel crews that got to the scene while the rescue and recovery operation was still underway.
My name's John Furr, and I'm in the 10th grade in London High School. And there were 150 of us in that class. I was in English room when this happened, and Miss Lizziella Thompson was teaching us, and we were studying the life of Edgar Allan Poe, and all of a sudden something went boom, and the roof fell in, and the back end of the building, our floor fell out. And the blackboard killed Miss Thompson, and there were about 22 in the room, and five of us got out.
I don't know of anything in my life other than maybe 9/11 that has been that shocking when you first realize the full scope of this disaster with so many little children that just had no chance.
News spread quickly once it began to be reported about the magnitude of this disaster and the tragic loss of human life, especially these children. Even Adolf Hitler relayed his condolences.
He sent a telegram the next day. Hitler sent a telegram. The chief of state of all the world powers sent telegrams. They came from Russia, from France, from Germany, from all of the world. And, of course, all the states sent messages to the governor of Texas and the school officials, you know, wishing them well and offering all sorts of help. And you imagine a 250-foot-long school. That's a big pile of rubble. There were 700 students in the building when it exploded. You know that about 300 were killed instantly. There were children throughout the debris that had to be saved. So that this rescue work had to be done carefully. They couldn't just drive a bulldozer over it. They used the drag lines to lift some of the heavier boulders. But mostly they used just pure back strength, arms and shoulders, and baskets, peach baskets that they filled with debris and handed back man to man and emptied and then passed forward again.
It's a story of tragedy, but it's also a story of people coming together and dealing with tragedy and overcoming it and persevering.
That was the reason to write it. Two reasons for me. One is that I felt that these children and teachers should be remembered. You know, we do remembrances, human beings do remembrances for tragedies that we think had a strong impact on us as a society, and this one certainly did. It's been forgotten for some reason, a little bit hidden in history, but their lives certainly showed us the way in how to make schools safer and how to handle natural gas and other natural resources more carefully.
Did they build a new school on that same site?
Same site, just a little back from where the original school stood. Actually, same building, almost same type building. It's shaped like a giant letter E with a yellow brick and red tile roof, and it looks very similar to it, kind of eerie going into the building and when you know what the old school was like. The monument is called a cenotaph. That's Greek for empty tomb, and that was chosen because so many of the victims literally were not recovered.
David M. Brown is the author of the book Gone at 317, The Untold Story of the Worst School Disaster in American History. There will be a memorial and a reunion of the remaining survivors of the school explosion at the London Museum and Cafe in New London, Texas, on March 18th, 80 years after that blast that took approximately 300 lives. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You can also comment directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. And that's where you can listen to past Texas Matters programs. And you can find us on iTunes. And tune in next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.